Hi, welcome to the show. With the market eking out new highs, it's time to bring back Turney Duff. Turney is a former Wall Street trader and contributor to the show Billions. And Turney follows Wall Street, but in a bit of a different way. He polls his many Wall Street contacts about what expensive cars they're buying or if they're being naughty with escorts. The more of any of these they're doing, the more of a bubble we may find ourselves in.
If you are making a couple of million dollars a year or north of that, they are starting to feel more comfortable spending frivolously.
Also, William Green, co-author of The Great Minds of Investing, gets us some insights to the characteristics and behaviors that are necessary to reach the highest levels of investing success.
Rule number one of investing, don't lose. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one.
And do you know if your spouse is cheating on you financially? Couples experts Chris and Marlo Felton share the signs to look for to see if your marriage is headed south due to financial funny business.
Avoiding the conversation could just be death to a relationship.
Plus, three big mistakes retirees seem to always make, and of course, so much more. So stay tuned. Here we go. In the 35 years I've worked as a financial planner, I fielded a lot of questions about retirement and heard a lot of angst about the right and wrong ways to plan for and manage the money side of it. Today, I want to address three of the most common mistakes and misunderstandings that I see retirees make, often with painful results. It's one of those situations where you can benefit from other people's mistakes and, you know, boy, there's nothing as good as benefiting from other people's mistakes. So I hope that you can store the general ideas away in your memory and bring them up later in conversation, perhaps with your financial advisor. The first mistake has to do with electing to receive Social Security benefits too early. Did you know that if you opt to receive Social Security benefits in the first year, you can receive them at age 62, and that your monthly benefits will be as much as 30% smaller than they would be if you waited to collect at full retirement ages, which is around 66 or 67, depending on your birth year? Or that if you delay your Social Security benefits until 3 or 4 years after full retirement age, you'll see your benefits grow by 32%. The longer you wait to apply for Social Security benefits, the higher your monthly checks will be. Not only that, but the differences can be pretty dramatic. You'll receive nearly twice as much per month if you wait until you turn 70 than if you start at age 62. That's some pretty powerful stuff and important numbers for you. If you've already made the decision to receive Social Security benefits early or even at full retirement age, you may be able to back out. You may be able to put your checks on hold and wait until the benefit amount gets larger. Those who have been receiving benefits for less than a year can withdraw their application for those early benefits and reapply later. In this scenario, you pay all the benefits you've already received back to Social Security. The process is pretty simple, but it does get a little more complicated for those who have reached full retirement age and have automatically begun receiving benefits. You can suspend the monthly checks for up to 4 years or until age 70. For each year you do this, there's an 8% bump in the amount you'll receive when that suspension comes off. An important side note is, for both of these scenarios, is that spousal and survivor benefits will also be suspended while your benefits are being delayed. So that's an important consideration. I've done a number of segments on this issue. Just come to our website, stevepomerantz.com, and then put in Social Security in the search bar, and you'll see a lot of great segments on this. Knowing exactly when to start and how to claim Social Security benefits can be, as one expert put it on fool.com, diabolically complicated. This is especially true when children are in the equation and you'll need to grapple with family benefits. It's generally a good idea to seek professional advice when it comes to figuring out Social Security benefits and how that should fit within your overall retirement plans. Now, the second mistake people make is investing too conservatively during retirement. This one can be a little tricky because conventional wisdom suggests that as you get older, you should shift the assets around in your retirement portfolio from riskier investments like stocks to less risky investments like bonds. Now, many early retirees try to do too much of this rebalancing too quickly. So they pull most of their money out of equities and put it into conservative, lower return assets in search of wealth preservation. Considering the traumatic losses that investors were dealt during 2008 and the dot-com market meltdowns, it's no wonder that retirees are eager to cut back on their stock holdings and coast on money markets, bonds, and fixed annuities. The problem is that they forget that retirement could last 30 years. Simply put, to enjoy financial comfort for 2+ decades of retirement, you may need a higher rate of return on your savings during retirement than what pure conservative investments can really provide, especially these days with bond interest rates being so low. And these low returns can hurt your standard of living when you think about the effects of inflation. Rising prices will continually eat away at the purchasing power of your savings. So yes, even though inflation has been low for more than a decade, the interest rates on bonds, CDs, and money market funds and savings accounts have been even lower. So your standard of living is slowly shrinking year after year. This all leads to the thought about whether or not your money will last throughout your lifetime. Under this low return scenario, many will wonder if their money will last their lifetime. It's a very real possibility and one that shouldn't be neglected. You don't want to find yourself relying entirely on Social Security. As a matter of fact, recently I did a segment entitled The Gray Nomads about people who are down basically to just living on Social Security and getting odd jobs. Not a really a great way to spend your final retirement years. So even if you only have a modest amount of money to work with, you should consider investing in stocks or some real estate so you may grow what's left. You should also do your best to be financially prepared for unknown hardships and expenses, particularly healthcare and possibly needing assisted living care or long-term in-home care later in life. And here's the last mistake. This is a mistake that I see retirees make continually, and that is they want to immediately pay off their mortgage. Now, I realize, though, that there's a powerful psychological appeal to being debt-free. But in reality, many people at or near retirement should consider not accelerating the payment of their mortgage. You know, I should note the reasons I'll list here do not apply to everyone, and you should try to get professional advice on your unique situation before making a decision to pay or not to pay off your mortgage. One compelling reason to hold off on retiring your mortgage is if you have credit card debt at much higher interest rates. Pay these and other high-interest loans off first. If you're still working and haven't contributed to the maximum amount to your IRA or 401k accounts, prioritize these over paying more towards your mortgage. On a related note, if your mortgage interest rate is relatively low, it's probably wise to divert funds from paying it off into investments in a diversified asset portfolio. Of course, this does involve taking on new risks, so you ought to compare your mortgage rate to a risk-free investment like a good quality bond. If the mortgage rate is higher, you may actually want to pay more towards the mortgage in this case. Also, if you plan on moving out of your home in a year or two, it's better not to pay off your mortgage. Finally, and this is something I see a lot and it's very important, if you have a modest amount of savings, don't use the bulk of it to pay off your mortgage. You might need it for emergencies, and you might need it to grow so you can accumulate more wealth. Remember, you do not want to be house poor. There are quite a few tax and other issues that I can't cover today, but a certified financial planner and tax accountant should be able to walk you through them. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. If money is the leading cause of divorce, how can you tell if your relationship is headed down that dark path? More specifically, how can you tell if your spouse is cheating on you financially? That's a question many find themselves asking, so let's find out what to look for. My guests are Chris and Marlo Felton, authors of The Prosperity Factor and Couples Money, What Every Couple Should Know About Money and Relationships. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Steve.
Welcome. Yeah. Thanks for having us.
So, you know, you've written that there are seven important signs your spouse or significant other or whatever is financially cheating on you. Number one is when you ask about money, they get defensive. Take us through that a little bit.
Well, you know, that's really important. And that's the number one clue that many people overlook. And when someone's needs aren't being met, they tend to sneak around and do things they shouldn't. And when someone's defensive, that's a telltale sign. Years ago, I like to tell the story of how I was unfaithful financially to my husband. And I have a need of lots of shoes, as my husband knows, right, honey? And
well,
I was purchasing
shoes. You were unfaithful?
Yes, yes. Okay. Financially, honey, just financially.
Oh, okay.
I was buying shoes because I liked them and I didn't want to tell Chris. And so I hide them in the trunk of my car and I didn't want to talk about it. So avoiding the conversation could just be death to a relationship. We fortunately came up with a good solution and talked it through so I don't have to do that anymore.
So Chris, now that Marlo has, you know, told her tale and come clean, is there anything you want to tell us?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can be uncomfortable, right? And so people avoid, you know, having uncomfortable conversations. And so they just continue to kick the can down the road. My unfaithfulness was just, you know, small spending here and there and happy hours and golf. And, you know, it just, the root of it was we just didn't really know where we were going as a couple. We had no clarity about what we were aiming for. And so, you know, if you don't know where you're going, then just every little shiny object will catch your attention. And that's what was happening to me.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, the point of all of this is to get communication going and to recognize these areas where you maybe based out of habit or, you know, just previous life experience, sometimes it's easier just to avoid confrontation on these issues. All right, let's go to the next one. Financial statements are disappearing if your partner is intercepting the mail before you have a chance to check the payments. I guess something's not right. Do you want to take us through some of that?
Well, yeah, you know, and we really believe that there should be complete financial transparency in a relationship. You know, any spouse that isn't willing to be financially transparent is hiding something. And that's really a warning sign.
I think when you get to that point, tell me if I'm wrong now, but when you get to the point where you're actually taking statements and maybe you're trying to come home early to get the mail, I mean, then something serious is really happening.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, when you're rushing on that, that's exactly right. Right. When you're creating that much stress in your life just to hide something, that's when you know you've gone way too far.
When your new best friend's the mailman? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. If you know the mailman by his first name or her first name, then maybe that's not such a great sign. All right, so the next one is unexpected and unrecognized account activity. You say bring up this topic in a casual way that really asks them more than accuses them. Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, part of what we teach our couples is if you need to have an uncomfortable conversation, we coach them on, you know, hey, Marlo, I want to talk to you about something, but I'm kind of afraid you're going to get mad at me.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of, you know, call out the elephant in the room. And so I'm hesitant to talk about it because, you know, I don't want it to get into an argument. And, you know, no, I'm not going to get mad at you. Are you sure? Because I don't want to go there with you, and I don't want to bring it up if it's going to lead to a fight. And so if you do that up front, and yeah, I mean, if you're accusing them, then they're defensive, and it's just, you know, it's just a disaster. But, you know, it also means the couple doesn't really have a clear way or a system or a code of honor about how they're going to communicate and bring stuff up. And if they create that ahead of time, because when emotion goes up, intelligence goes down.
Yeah.
So,
good point.
You know, if you create that ahead of time, then, you know, you're going to have a code to kind of follow and a way to have uncomfortable conversations and a system that people will follow through with versus jump into emotion.
Marlo, let me ask you a question. You know, when I was coming up, when I was first married many years ago, we had one bank account. We shared our bank account and checks went into the bank account. But I think couples these days have maybe three bank accounts, one for him, one for her, and maybe a shared bank account. Does this create more tendency towards secrecy, do you think?
Well, it can. But going back to what Chris said is, you know, getting clear on your goals first before you create your segregation system is incredibly important, because then it can avoid the uncomfortable conversation, because you can always go back to, okay, well, we agreed as a couple, this is where we want to be. This is what's important. These are our financial goals. But we do very strongly believe in segregation of funds, which is, I think, what you're referring to, or could be, you know, having the yours, mine, and ours. But it has to be really clear what those accounts are being used for, and how much is going into them each month, and that it's equal and agreed upon, so that you don't have the siphoning of money from one account, you know, like his account, right? Right, honey? Like if there's more money going in his account and Chris is out playing golf all the time and having great happy hours, I'd be like, what's going on over there? Mm-hmm. So there has to be the accountability. But we think that the one checking account system is really asking for trouble for a variety of reasons.
Okay, well, we don't have time to get into that, but that is an interesting point. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that at some future time. I guess what you guys are saying is that obviously a relationship needs to be built on trust, and you know, you're human and have a lot of emotional characteristics to their personalities, so sometimes that trust gets eroded. Here's one that I like. Your partner has new possessions, shoes, and experiences not involving you. Be wary of all your partner's new items, how they were obtained, if they were obtained with a great deal, quote unquote. Also, take note if your spouse's new hobbies are addictive activities like gambling or playing the lottery excessively. That could, of course, take a toll on bank accounts. And I think, you know, drugs and alcoholism comes in here. You know, this whole idea of you hiding your shoes in the trunk, you know, is kind of reminiscent of the alcoholic who's kind of hiding the bottle.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's really just the root of much more, you know, deeper problems.
Absolutely. Chris, you want to weigh in on this at all?
Yeah. I mean, I just kind of going previously, just, you know, our separate fund accounts, you know, just a set amount that her and I get every month, and it's the same. And, you know, once again, that's under the umbrella of, you know, one or two major financial goals that we have. And we're really clear on, hey, here's the reasons why we want it to happen. You know, here's the emotional reasons why we want to have these goals happen. And when we have that buy-in up front, but also having funds set aside, or you'll self-sabotage the plan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when that amount is spent every month, it's gone. And if we're clear on the major goals, then, you know, we're okay with that. So go have fun. Allocate money for fun. Do with it what you want. Buy what you want. But when it's gone, it's gone. You're not getting you know, any more. So that's been super, super helpful for us and the people we coach.
Well, that's good advice. We are out of time. My guests are Chris and Marlo Felton, and author of Couples Money, What Every Couple Should Know About Money and Relationships. And you can find them at couplesmoney.com, couplesmoney.com. And to find out more about Marlo and Chris Felton, and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. Turney Duff chronicled the spectacular rise and fall of his career on Wall Street in the book The Buy Side. And he's also a consultant on the Showtime show Billions, which is a show I really love. And he is featured on the CNBC show The Filthy Rich Guide, which airs Wednesday at 10 p.m. on CNBC. Now, we've spoken to Turney before and had some fun talking about the excesses of Wall Street when times are good. So I thought it would be a good time to revisit him and check out current Wall Street behavior now that we've seen the market rally so much in 2017. Hey, Turney, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Well, the last time we spoke about pricey Aston Martins going for $200,000 and $1,000 an hour escorts. And that was kind of the sign, you know, that the wild days of Wall Street are back. You know, would you say that since the presidential election, we're starting to see that kind of excitement again?
Definitely, it has increased, you know, and by collecting the data, you know, guys, well, I mean, women too, but women aren't calling escorts as far as I know, have definitely increased kind of their deviant factor. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not heading back towards where it was, but one interesting thing I'll tell you, which was not in my article. Equally so, I'm getting feedback from friends and other people, you know, acquaintances, whatnot, almost taking the other side and upset a little bit that this is being put in print. So You've got people who are, you know, starting to increase their spending habits on, let's say, you know, curricular activities, but you have an equal portion of the population who are much more sensitive to that. So it's kind of interesting.
Well, we've gone through a full turn here. I mean, you know, there were the wild days. There were the 90s, of course. I don't know if anything will ever match that again. But, you know, whenever Wall Street goes into these cycles, when you get to the up cycle, things can get pretty wild. The bonuses get really big and there's a lot of excess, you know, just kind of discretionary income. But the last few years, let's say, you know, maybe the Obama years, just to kind of encapsulate it, have been very conservative years. I mean, Obama himself was conservative and the markets had hurt a lot of people. The mortgage debacle and housing had hurt a lot of people. And the market has kind of climbed back slowly, but inexorably to its current point. Now, I know that you polled your contacts back in 2016. What were they saying to you last year?
You know, so it's interesting because, you know, 2 times ago when I polled them, people were much more inclined to save, which was definitely a dramatic shift from my days of being on Wall Street. But, you know, it all kind of makes sense, right? You know, you got 2008 and then for the next, you know, let's say 4 to 5 years, even though the market's recovering, no one feels safe. Expense accounts are being watched, You know, and there's some wealth shaming going on by the public, because if you walk into a party, let's say a cocktail party in 2003, and you say, oh, what do? And you're like, oh, I work at Morgan Stanley. The person will be like, oh. But in 2012, you walk into a cocktail party and say, oh, what do? And they're like, oh, I work at Morgan Stanley. They're like, oh.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So, you know, there's a little bit of that going on. And I know a lot of guys who, you know, it's like musical chairs. You know, every time the music stops, they pull a chair. And I know guys who've been trying to get back on the street for 3, 4, 5 years. And so the jobs, I believe, have changed and probably lessened. But if you are making a couple of $1 million a year or north of that, they are starting to feel more comfortable spending frivolously.
Well, you know, you use this term wealth shaming, and I think that's a very accurate term. Again, when so many people are suffering and you have the 99%ers and the 1%ers and, you know, that cultural environment, there's a lot of resentment to the small amount of population that's doing extremely well. People are hiding their wealth. They're keeping it under wraps. They may be doing things, but they're doing it out of the public eye and they're being very careful about it. And then in walks Donald Trump, who is unashamed of his lavish lifestyle, His children all, you know, are proud of it and display it proudly. And now you're starting to see, well, you know, I mean, when you look at any decent website or upscale website or magazine, you know, these diamond encrusted Cartier watches are now, and the Piagets are
right,
being advertised pretty heavily. So I think the cycle is turning against this wealth shaming, and now, you know, it's becoming once again okay to display your wealth.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that assessment. You know, in the early 2000s, I used to describe my life as, you know, a couple of gold chains short of a hip hop video. You know, like it was nuts.
That's a pretty embarrassing thing for you to admit, by the way.
Oh, whatever. You know, it's the truth. What do you want me to, you know?
Yeah, okay.
I'm not gonna lie.
Okay.
But it might be coming back, and not to throw us off topic or a curveball, and we don't have to get into politics because I know
we don't want,
you know,
to.
People have their own opinions, but trickle down economics has never worked. Okay. And, you know, they're going to take a stab at it again. And I can guarantee, well, I guess I can't guarantee you, but if I just take myself, right, and compare myself from 10, 15 years ago, I am not going to spend like I did 10, 15 years ago, or I'm going to need 2x in my savings account before I make certain purchases. So to think that companies or investors or whoever are going to pass down, you know, their wealth, I'm sorry, the bar has changed.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it's not going to work.
Well, I won't get into, you know, the idea whether, you know, trickle down right. works or not. I mean, that's another discussion. But I think you do make a good point, and that is that the world has changed and become seemingly more unstable. You mentioned Wall Street jobs, people losing their jobs, unable to get back.
Right, right.
And with technology moving as fast as it is, people just feel more insecure. So there is this tendency for everybody to want to kind of stuff their chairs with cash,
yep,
you know, and their bank accounts, and just kind of have this margin of safety sitting in your own account because you just don't really feel secure about,
yes,
you know, the your future.
I 100%. And, you know, I look at myself in 2007, right? I bought a $2.1 million house. I put 600 down, so I borrowed 1.5. You know, the previous year, I don't know, I probably made like $700,000 or something. But in a million years, I wouldn't do that right now.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No,
yeah,
right. Like, that's crazy.
Right.
But it seemed normal back then.
My guest is Turney Duff. He chronicled his spectacular rise and fall on Wall Street in a book, The Buy Side. He's also a consultant on the Showtime program Billions. And he's also featured on CNBC's show Filthy Rich Guide. So now we've talked a little bit about your polling your contacts in 2016. I guess 2017, people are being a little bit more freer in their spending. But the reason I'm asking all these, I don't really care what people spend. I don't really like watching shows like, you know, The Lives of the Rich and Famous. I couldn't care less. But I look at it as a sign as to whether we're approaching a top in the market, you know, this irrational exuberance, this frothiness.
Right.
And I'm getting a sense from you that we're not there yet.
Yeah, I would agree with that, that we're not there, at least in terms of this indicator. But, and I don't know how much this also plays into the fact, but, you know, in those early Obama years, Wall Street was public enemy number one, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
We were the only enemy in town. And now, you know, you have Republicans hate Democrats, Democrats hate Republicans, the media hates DC, DC hates media. Like, there's a lot of other distractions now. And so Wall Street's probably not feeling as hated, and they're a little more comfortable to be spending their money in public. But, you know, in terms of just kind of being too excessive, I don't think we're there yet, but
it's starting. It seems like we're at the beginning, or not the beginning, maybe we're in the third inning or something like that.
Right. Right.
Of that. So we want to keep tabs on that. I'm going to be getting in touch with you from time to time to see what the meter says with regards to Aston Martin's, Cartier watches, and escorts, you know?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the Filthy Rich Guide. We've got about a minute left.
Sure. So it's interesting you say that you don't like shows like Lifestyles of Rich Famous.
Exactly.
No, because this is probably the perfect show for you, because it's actually a cynical, sort of snarky look at the ridiculous things that some of these billionaires do. So, you know, yes, there's some wealth porn element to it, but it's a funny sort of snarky look at it. So it's a fun show.
Okay, cool. My guest, Tony Duff. The show is The Filthy Rich Guide. It airs on Wednesday on CNBC at 10 p.m. Hey, Tony, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
To find out more about Tony and to hear this interview again, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Terry Story and Real Estate Roundup is next.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So there's a lot of people out there looking to buy homes, but there aren't a lot of homes for sale. This has been a meme that we've been pursuing for many, many years. Homeowners aren't moving. Why are they not moving? We got to get them to move.
I know. It's affecting my lifestyle. It's actually creating a drag on the economy.
Yeah.
And I know it's going to sound silly. It's going to be a fewer commission for real estate brokers and extremely competitive market for the first time home buyers.
Yeah.
What I mean by that, Steve, if you think about it, I think I had read someplace that the average real estate transaction creates about $75,000 or more in revenue. So you're paying real estate agents, your title companies, attorneys, all of that turns into, once a home is purchased, there's movers involved, there's painters, there's furniture.
Yeah.
So it is a huge segment of our economy.
It all trickles down to the Home Depot, to all of these places.
Absolutely.
Very good for the economy. Housing is extremely good for the economy. Maybe it's one of the major reasons why the economy is growing still so anemically. Now, you know, back in 2008, when we talked about this in 2006 and 7 after the real estate crisis or during it, we understood that homes weren't moving because people were underwater.
That's right.
They owed more than their equity, and so they couldn't move.
When they lost their jobs and they were in foreclosure.
Right.
And the tenure of moving was from three and a half years back in 2008. Now it's almost 9 years. So people are staying put. But the reason why they're staying put that we're seeing than what we had seen in the past is primarily because they have no place to move to. Now, if you think about it, if a seller then becomes a buyer.
Yeah.
So if there's no inventory out there, and I see it firsthand, Steve, I'll go and I'll meet with people, they're sellers, they want to sell their home. But when they take a look at what's out there, they're like, yeah, no, I think my house is, I'm going to stay put.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what are they looking for? They're looking for more space. I mean, there's got to be an impetus to move.
Yeah, there does. You know, in a lot of cases, you know, if it's somebody that's at their end of their career, they're looking to scale down.
Yeah.
If it's a young family, they're looking for more space. In those scenarios, I find that those that are trying to move up, they're finding it too expensive.
Uh-huh.
What happens when you move up, you're taking on higher taxes, more expenses, and as much as they desire it, they can't afford it, even with the low interest rates. And I think still people, you know, still have memories of what took place back in, 2006.
I think I have a solution. I just read that a small Italian village in Italy is paying people to come and live there. That's one thing. And I also read recently that, I forget how many castles, but the Italian government is offering Italian castles now for free to anyone that will come in and fix them up and spend the money to make them a tourist destination.
I love it.
That's it. So I don't know if that's buying up, buying down. I'm not really sure, but it is Italy. The food is really, really good. Yeah. All right. So here's the other thing too, is that everywhere I look around in my neighborhood and the area which I live, there's so many rental properties being built. Hundreds and hundreds of units are entering the marketplace, and rents themselves are going up very, very fast. I think there's a time now where the case may be made. It's cheaper to buy than to rent.
Yeah. I'll give you a scenario, Steve. The median rent in the U.S. is about $1,400 a month. Now, if you're able to spend $1,400 a month, that's the equivalent of purchasing of a home of about $290,000. Mm-hmm. So keep in mind that the median home value is $196,000. So if you're buying a house for $290,000, that's more expensive than the median home. So the rent is really up there.
Yeah, that's a good way of explaining it. When you compare apples to apples, it is definitely cheaper to own than to rent. And yet the demand for rentals is so high. Why do you think that is?
You know, I haven't quite figured it out. I know, and I can only speak what I see in the local marketplace. And I know it's going to sound crazy, but to try to find something to rent, like in a single family home, is very, very tight. Now, I know in our marketplace, there's a lot of new construction for rentals.
Yeah.
But those places are very expensive.
They are. They are.
Like ridiculously expensive, $3,000, $5,000 a month. And it's really out of control. So to find a single family home for rent and for what you get, it's extremely high.
I guess it comes down to the same point that if a renter is going to buy, who is he going to buy from? There's a lack of sellers.
Right, right.
So it's this vicious cycle. Something's got to break it. And maybe it's just the demographic shift. As people get older and they want to downsize, maybe they'll move out of their area, move into other areas where there is more availability, and that will somehow free up the capital. Now, 37 of the 50 cities that Zillow analyzed said that renters could buy a home worth more than the median value of the home in the city without spending more on monthly housing, with the exception of San Francisco.
Yeah, San Francisco. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's cheaper to rent than it is to own a house there.
All right, final question. This is from the Real Estate Survival Guide. The question was, when will mortgage rates rise and what happens when they do?
Ah, gosh, I wish I had that crystal ball.
Well, we don't know when, that's for sure.
Let's paint a situation, a scenario. Mm-hmm. So if mortgage rates surge 60 basis points.
That's 0.6%.
Right, 0.6%. In theory, they believe it would lower house prices by 2 to 3%.
Okay.
And this is an estimate, and this is from Goldman Sachs.
Okay.
This estimate thus supports the forecast that national housing prices will continue to rise, but at a slower pace in the next few years.
From my side of the table, watching interest rates daily as I do, the expectations for higher interest rates have been now around for maybe 3 years.
Right.
And they haven't. They did rise from last year after the election, but they're starting to come down again. And I don't think mortgage rates really have moved all of that much.
No, and from my perspective, the way that I see it, if interest rates do rise, more people jump off the fence. And we have so many buyers right now. The demand for housing is so strong.
Yeah.
It's just going to create more demand. So I don't think it'll have that much of an impact in the short run.
Okay, problems we can't solve, but questions we can ask and do our best. My guest is Terry Story. This is our Real Estate Roundup segment. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I met my next guest at the Latticework Conference in New York City last year. I had never heard of him or read his work, but the more I looked into him, the more interested I became. Now, in May of this year, I attended the Berkshire Hathaway shareholder meeting in Omaha, and on Friday, before the meeting, I attended a conference on value investing. In the back of the room, I noticed a large book containing the profiles of the great investors of our time, and my next guest actually wrote the profiles in that book as well, so it was an interesting confluence of events. William Green has written for Time, Fortune, Forbes, Fast Company, The New Yorker, The Economist, and he's here today to share what he's learned from his interviews with the unique individuals that have become the greatest investors of our time. William Green, welcome to the show.
Hi, Steve. I'm delighted to be here with you.
So let's begin talking about the book. The book is entitled The Great Minds of Investing. And, you know, William, there's a lot of investing books on the market. I guess the question is, why another one? Why is this one important?
I think it's unusual, certainly, whether it's important or not, I don't know. But it's very unusual, I think, in A, that it's a combination of photographs and profiles of these guys. So you have these extraordinary photographs taken by Michael O'Brien, who will be right up in the face of someone like Warren Buffett or his partner, Charlie Munger. So you're looking in the eyes of these extraordinary people, which gives you this kind of strange perspective on them. You feel almost like you're looking into their soul. And then you have these profiles. I wrote 22 of them and edited about 11 of them, which give you another way of looking at these people's lives. And so what I'm trying to do in the profiles is give you a very human look at these extraordinarily successful people. So I'm trying to give a sense of what you can learn about investing from them, but also what you can learn from them about how to live. So if I give you one sort of somewhat random example, there's an extraordinary investor there, Jean-Marie Evayard, who's one of the greatest international investors, really over probably 3 or 4 decades. And I asked Jean-Marie about his success and how well he'd done, why he'd done so well. And then I said to him, you know, as you look back on your life, do you have any regrets? And he said to me very brutally, honestly, he said, yeah, I wish I'd been a better father. Mm. And he said, I wish I'd focused more on my two daughters when they were growing up. And he said, but I was so absorbed with investing, and investing is so hard and it's so psychologically demanding that, you know, I kind of neglected my family. And I said to him, well, if you had paid more attention to your kids, do you think you would have been as successful an investor? And he said, you know, I just don't know. You know, life isn't simple. And so for me, that kind of embodies what we were trying to do with the book, to give this sense of how to invest, of how to be successful, but also to look a little more deeply and say, yeah, but what constitutes success? And, you know, there's another extraordinary investor in the book, Donald Yachtman, who actually was a Mormon bishop at one point, and then later managed about $40 billion. And he said to me, no amount of professional success compensates for failure at home.
Yeah, wow.
So I'd like to think that the book at some level is important or unusual or interesting because it actually makes you think about your life and how to live your life and what the lessons of these extraordinary investors are that we can kind of, you know, take into our own lives so that we live successfully on multiple levels.
Yeah, well, you know, that's one thing that you do notice with the book is that the pictures are really not about the icons, but more about the humans, the real people beneath that. And some of the profiles explain that as well. As a matter of fact, when I was in Omaha, I saw a Jean-Marie Evayard, and I went up to him and introduced myself, and he's going to be on the show in the next couple of weeks, and I got his book. And this is one humble gentleman here. I mean, to me, he was an icon because I've been in the investment business for 35 years. And I mean, I basically grew up on following Mr. Evayard and his funds, the First Eagle funds and SoGen and all of that. So to meet him in person and then for him to be so just basically human and what you said is so true. What are some of the other sayings or phrases that you came away with from some of the other investors that were meaningful to you and that would help us understand the nature of investing?
So one of the most important insights that I got in the book actually came from this extraordinary investor called Irving Kahn. And Irving actually died at the age of 109 mm-hmm. in 2015. And you have to bear in mind that this is a man who had absolutely seen everything. I mean, he was born in 1905, starts on Wall Street in 1928, lives through the crash of 1929, through World War II, Vietnam, Gulf War, the financial crisis in 2008, countless recessions and crashes. And so I said to him a few weeks before he passed away, I had the chance to ask him a few questions. And I said, so if you were to share a single piece of financial advice with us, what would it be? And what Irving said, which I thought was extraordinarily profound, even though it's very simple, was he said, considering the downside is the single most important thing an investor must do. And he said, before you start thinking about how much you can make on any stock or any investment you buy, you've got to think about the downside, what you can lose. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, if you achieve only reasonable returns and you suffer minimal losses, you're going to become very wealthy. Yeah. And he said, you're actually going to surpass any of your gambler friends. And he said to me, it was lovely. He said, this is also a good way to cure your sleeping problems.
Well, you know, if you're going to live 109 years, I would tend to agree the benefits of compounding really work some tremendous magic when you're over 100 years old, for sure.
Yeah, but I think for all of us, you know, we have this tendency to sort of buy lottery tickets and to think, you know, I'm going to get this big, big score. I'm going to make this venture capital investment, or I'm going to invest in some hot stock that everyone likes. You know, everyone loves Tesla or everyone loves Amazon. I'm going to roll the dice and I'll get rich. And in my experience, every time I've messed up in my own life as an investor, it's been because I got greedy and I got in a hurry.
Yeah.
And I think when you look at someone like Irving Kahn, who, you know, he didn't just do well over one cycle. This is a guy who did well over what, you know, 1928 to 2015, over 85 years. And that's an extraordinarily powerful lesson. And I think it's something Buffett talks about again and again. You know, he'll say, you know, rule number one of investing, don't lose. Rule number two, don't forget rule number one.
William, I want to take you back to this idea about Irving Kahn having experienced all these cycles. And he said, consider the downside. One of the tenets that you mentioned in a talk that you gave to Google as a characteristic to be a very successful investor was the ability to take pain, the emotional resilience that leads to success over many decades. I mean, it's been said that, you know, investing is simple, but it's not easy. And you told the story of Bill Miller, the great mutual fund manager. Tell us a little bit about him very, very quickly, because there's a lot of other things I want to get to.
Sure. Well, Miller was, in many ways, the greatest mutual fund manager in history. He famously beat the market 15 years running, which is really like defying gravity. It's an astonishing thing to do. And then having been right for decades, in 2008, 2009, he just got absolutely crushed.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of his funds went down 55%, another went down 65%. And his assets under management went down from something like $77 billion to $800 million. So a loss of something like 90%, assets just flooding out as people despaired and thought, suddenly, this genius is an idiot.
Yeah.
And to me, it's just this incredibly powerful reminder that even someone as brilliant as Bill, and he truly is brilliant, can get hammered in the market. And so you need this tremendous resilience. And Bill, you know, is wonderfully honest about it. I mean, he said to me that he put on 40 pounds, he had to lay off 100 people, and he said it was very hard. But what he found enormously helpful was actually he had studied a lot of philosophy, and he turned to Stoic philosophers like Epictetus and Seneca. And a lot of what they talk about is that it's not really the external events in your life that matter, it's your attitude towards them. And so he drew tremendous solace from the fact that, you know, he could deal with his suffering with a kind of nobility and resilience. And he got back on the horse, and the fund that he's been running has been extraordinarily successful for the last few years.
One of the other characteristics, and I think this is probably one of the toughest parts of being that successful as an investor, is this willingness to be lonely, as you put it, to diverge from the crowd, to be a free thinker and willing to, you know, to withstand the pain of going the opposite direction. You know, everybody says buy low, sell high, but it's really one of the hardest things to actually accomplish successfully over time. You tell the story about Templeton.
Yeah.
And what he did in 1939. Tell us that.
Yeah. Well, Templeton, again, was one of these investors who had success over 50, 60 years, astonishing, enduring success. And maybe about 17, 18 years ago, I went to interview Templeton in the Palmers, where he had this exquisite house. And I remember kind of watching him exercise. He didn't realize I was there, but I was watching him exercise in the water. And he would run in the water, looking crazy, sort of with his face slathered in sun cream, wearing this crazy hat with ear flaps. And I just remember thinking, here's a guy who just doesn't care what anybody thinks about what he does. And he invested in the same ways. In the middle of World War II, when Germany has just invaded Paris and the whole world seems to be coming to an end, he buys all of these basically bankrupt stocks or stocks on the verge of bankruptcy, the point of maximum pessimism, as he put it. And over the next 5 years, I think it was, he quintupled his money. And so this is an example of just how much courage you have to have, how much conviction you have, how capable you need to be of diverging from the crowd if you want to outperform. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the lessons for the rest of us, if we don't have that kind of temperament or that kind of genius, is to say, all right, well, so if I'm not going to be able to diverge from the crowd like that, maybe I should join the crowd. So maybe I should own an index fund,
right?
Which is an acceptance in a way of solid mediocrity. It's like, I'm not going to be the best. I'm not going to be a world beater, but I'm going to win by not losing. I'll do better than 90% of people. And that's an important discovery.
It's interesting that you bring that up because, first of all, one of the, I think, chief criteria to be successful is to know yourself, but also to have the humility to say, you know what, I do not have the temperament to withstand the pain. And really, over time, that average person, that investor, should invest in a broad range of indices in order to just capture the generic average returns. And over enough years, you will create a decent amount of wealth, right?
I think you're absolutely right. It's a very good default solution that works for almost everyone. And Howard Marks, who's one of the greatest investors alive, who manages over $100 billion, said to me that most people should be indexing most of their money. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. I think if you have an extraordinary temperament or you have a particular advantage in a particular area, then okay, roll the dice with a few things. Pick a handful of stocks or pick a fund if you know a lot about funds. I wouldn't do it with all of your money. In a way, it's almost hedging against your own overconfidence. It's saying, you know, yeah, maybe I'm really smart, but what if I'm not? And I think that's a really powerful way of just being realistic about yourself.
This idea of the power of humility, I mean, you mentioned that Howard Marks, not a household name, but we've done episodes or segments on him for the show. And he says the worst thing that you can do is think that you're master of the universe, because really the future is extremely uncertain and the only constant is impermanence. And so when the average person is watching CNBC or listening to someone say they've got a foolproof system for telling the future and being able to guide your investments that way, to watch out for that, because it's just not possible to foretell the future and to invest as if you can.
Exactly. I think one of the wisest ways to think about this is to say, I'd rather get rich slowly. And there's no shame in that. And, you know, we're often kind of duped into thinking that everyone else is getting rich, and you watch, you know, you watch Jim Cramer on TV making out that this is like a horse race, and, you know, your neighbor or your brother-in-law tells you how rich they're getting on Tesla or something. And I think just to keep that noise out and just say, no, I'm quietly sticking to my knitting. I'm not going to have any leverage. I'm not going to have a lot of debt. I'm going to have a margin of safety. I'm going to buy stuff that's sensible. And I'm going to put more money away every year, and I'm going to do it in a tax-effective way.
Right.
These relatively sane, relatively simple things, if you compound that sensible behavior over 10, 20, 30, 40 years, you'll end up being extraordinarily rich. And a lot of those people who've been boasting to you about how well they've been doing rolling the dice will end up, you know, looking at you thinking, how the hell did that happen? Because I was so smart.
Well, Buffett said it at the conference. He said, there's nothing worse than your neighbor who you definitely convinced is not as smart as you, making a killing in the market while you're sitting there doing nothing. There's nothing more humiliating and frustrating to have someone do that. But those are the kinds of feelings that you have to put aside and put asunder in order to stay the course and stay on track and be successful over time. William Green, we are out of time. What an interesting discussion. I thank you so much for spending your time to be with us. The Great Minds of Investing can be found at greatmindsofinvesting.com. And William Green, are you working on anything new?
I am, Steve. I'm working on a book that in a way has grown out of this one. So I'm looking more deeply at some of the themes that came out of this book. So trying to figure out what can I learn from the world's best investors, not just about how to get rich, but actually about how to think better and how to live more wisely.
To find out more about William and to hear this interview again, join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. This week on the On the Money Minute, retirement planning and estate planning combined. Hi, Steve Pomerantz with today's On the Money Minute. Let's talk about estate planning and some required elements of it. When it comes to retirement and estate planning, the most important thing to know is that an estate plan has several elements: a will, an assignment of power of attorney, and a living will, or what is referred to as a healthcare proxy. At the most fundamental level, those three documents are essential to protecting your family and your assets. When you're putting together an estate plan, keep in mind particular federal and state laws so that everything is done properly and legally. There are numerous online sites to put together your own documents. However, I would suggest the services of a competent estate planning lawyer. Hey, if you want more on the money, don't forget to follow us at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Or facebook.com/The Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on The Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by The Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which The Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.